typical people you see on the financial news, you know, what they had to say about, you know, they seem to be getting optimistic again. The stuff you see on, I guess, Fox or CNN. What is it that the mainstream media is missing out on, other than their lack of understanding of the brain?
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah. There was a gentleman I had lunch with years ago telling me that interesting. They just shut the sound off and just watched the picture on CNBC. You can tell just from the way they're smiling, whether they're talking about an up market or whether the market's down. And maybe even learn just about as much, you know, from watching that. It's been about two or three months since I've watched some of the economists speak about. The economic indicators, and they just don't look at it those indicators very systematically at all. And so I usually don't watch because I find it just gets me annoyed. You know, it's like knowing how to repair a car and seeing the garage mechanic that allows a judge rather than that. No. But with respect to, you know, CNBC and those other, CNBC in particular that I have some familiarity with, clearly they want a bull market. I mean, it's amazing, of course, when you look. I spoke to somebody in TV not long ago who said that nobody believed that you could actually do a whole day-long show on just, you know, one sport, you know, the markets, and it used to exist. But obviously, you know, your team has to win with a reasonable regularity, otherwise the fans won't watch. You know? And so they have a certain stake, you know, in hoping that market will rise. And so, for that reason, I don't personally learn very much at all from watching those shows. And the reason, other than just being sort of annoyed or at times understanding what the conventional view, so I wouldn't trust them either. But I mean, but that said, I actually am. I don't totally disagree with what Sean said about inflation. I do think that not very different from the consensus, and certainly not different from. Frank, that the market is that the economy is poised to rebound. It'll be a subpar rebound in the sense that it'll be like 4% rebound from recession, which is actually below average. It usually does about 5-6%. I hope the market, the stock market, will flatten. I don't certainly from these valuations. I hope we don't see any kind of bull market from here. That's just a hope, not a forecast. Then just one other point, non-linearly on what Mark talking about war. The other question mark that's overhanging the economy is to what degree will productivity be subject to a drag. And because of September 11th, you put up a building, you need twice as many guards around it, you need to protect your capital, you need to have duplicative computer systems, and so everything, there's that surcharge that's imposed on the economy, and so we're seeing some evidence of it already, that will mean that some of the investment that we're going to see is just, unfortunately, investment that's similar to having a crime wave and having to make new investment to protect yourself against the criminals. The hope and the interesting interaction between innovation and need is that possibly we won't need twice as many guards. There are lots of companies that are gearing up to try to provide a cheaper way to protect a building. But that's a question mark about going forward. Anyway, I'll shut up and let Sean answer.
Well, I think Gene has made the point that we all know that CNBC has become America and probably Western Europe's national sport in the last few years. And quite rightly, I concur with the fact that you don't expect the guys trying to sell you something to sell you news that puts you off those purchases. So there is a huge seasonal adjustment bias that needs to be done when you listen to that program, basically.
Subsidy that particular author had received from the IMF.
Absolutely, sure. Yeah.
Has that ever been discussed in newsrooms as a possibility, just to alert the audience to the bias or the vested interest the author has in the institution about which they're writing?
There's usually, I wonder if you, do you have something in particular in mind?
Brzezinski. He was writing a lot about Chechnya during the Bosnian campaign. Yeah. I found it particularly irritating because at the same time he was collecting very handsome fees as a consultant to Big Oil when they're trying to build this east-west energy corridor, and I felt very definitely that critical information was being misrepresented to the public, and that he writes as a former Secretary of State, and that confuses the audience, not in his position as a consultant to Big Oil.
Yeah, he was actually, he wasn't, he never made Secretary of State, even though he dearly, did he?
Yes,
he was head of National Security.
Same difference.
Yeah, well, I mean, Brzezinski, of course, is a good case of somebody who's clearly such a not an aggressive start. I mean, if he isn't specifically being bribed by power, his whole identification is with the men and who run the world that, you can immediately discount it. And even though I heartily agree with you that all affiliations should be stated, I partially will credit the media because usually they want to find out, somebody writes a letter to the editor, what is your affiliation, who do you work for specifically, but then more subtle consultancies and so on are less well known. But still, I think Brzezinski is a good example of all of them. I mean, Paul Krugman writes a column for the Times and he teaches at Princeton, so I don't know what else he gets, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, his whole identification is with those people. You can more or less make an adjustment whenever you read any of these, without discounting your point, which is it's always good to know whatever else this person has in mind. I mean, certainly you could say, what's the problem with we know, of course, the problem with the sell-side analysts on Wall Street is that there's a certain corruption there. What could you say against Barron's or the Wall Street Journal? Well, I mean, the one thing that corrupts journalism, journalism like at Barron's, where really there's no, we're kept away even from, from our advertisers. There's no way for us to be corrupt in that way, other than a few real corrupting trying to front run an article in Barron's, which you could do. But journalism is, of course, corrupted by the fact that it always wants to put sizzle in the story, and overly sizzle. There's an exaggerate what goes on by grabbing your attention. That's always a problem with journalism. So I would still say my main concern is always understanding that whether this person has really been bribed or not, just have some idea of where that person's coming from and then adjust for bias. And then even then you might be able to learn even something on somebody like Brzezinski.
Yeah, I think there's a little aphorism about that with CNBC, and it said something about it should carry a Surgeon General's warning, which says that smoking what these guys smoke can seriously damage your wealth.
Strikes me about the business press is just how they're sort of swayed by whatever the most recent number is, and once, twice, or three times a day, there's some new piece of data that comes out, and then however it's reported, they try to draw some broad conclusions. So, jobless claims are up, and oh no, we're still in recession. Wait, housing starts are up. We're recovering, and this kind of this relentless prattling, it just goes on all the time. And if you look at something like Yahoo Financial page, you can see them sort of piling on top of each other. Good news, bad news, good news, bad news.
Well, I think the other thing as well is you have like Bill Dudley tells the Goldman sales team, who tell the Goldman brokers, who tell the Goldman mutual fund managers, who tell their clients, who tell the pension funds, and it comes all back around in a circle to the six talking heads on CNBC who spout this all as if it was their received wisdom and perception of the economy in the first place. The problem with that program, of course, is not the format for anybody to cross-examine them, although Mark Haynes' cynicism and quiet nuances of tone sometimes gives the impression that not everybody's there, is dead from the neck up. But I mean, it's a 24-hour rolling commercial for the stock market, and you have to take it as it comes.
Picking up on Jeff's point, certainly no the Commerce Department, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, always will stress, if you speak to those statisticians, that these numbers, first of all, are subject to revision, even though, like the unemployment insurance plan, think of them being 2 weeks subject to revision, is also can be extremely volatile. And so I don't, there's not a single economic indicator that doesn't need require a little you know, little sixth grade arithmetic. Unemployment insurance plans are conventionally a 4 week moving average, and then even then you don't know that trend. But that unfortunately there's been a kind of a collision between the demand of the market. I mean, if the market closes down on a Friday, then it's not revised on Monday that it did close down. And so the market wants a certain amount of surety about a particular number, a particular estimate. And unfortunately, the statistical bureaucracies are just not up to it. And so even though the most recent number you think is most valuable, it's most subject to revision and also subject to volatility, so it needs to be smoothed out. And that, as Jeff was saying, you read over again this particular number and that particular number, and it's meaningless, except other than to put in context of the moving average.
But the revisions are hardly ever headlined, right?
Yeah.
No, because they're old news. And financial markets work on the premise that somebody somewhere comes up with a forecast, a consensus of those forecasts is put together, and then the market trades off what the discrepancy from the consensus forecast is, and then there's a double bluff of seeing whether we've reacted to the discrepancy in the right way, which gives you a hint of the psychology of the market. So it's meaningless anyway. It's just a marker on the football pitch against which we can measure whether we've carried the ball or not.
Is it possible to say, well, look, here are three or four things that you should really look at and just kind of put everything else aside?
Not always, but I mean, right now, for example, you mentioned unemployment insurance against the fact that the average over the past several weeks has been a little above 400,000, which compares to close to 500,000. That's I think, got some kind of indication of the job market right now strengthening. What's called the National Association of Purchasing Management, or they changed their name, I forget what.
ISM, I think. Yeah. Institute of Supply Management, I think.
That ISM figure actually correlates the recently reported number, and it does have a history of stability, doesn't usually get revised away or changed that much, not that volatile. It does correlate with a slight rebound in manufacturing. And I think it's a good indicator right now. Some of the things I would point to as signs that the economy is probably rebounding. Yes?
I think that one number that is extremely useful to say the work that I do is really getting a handle on price inflation. Mm-hmm. It's useful in income issues, et cetera. And you know, they're fudging with this thing for years now, and they're about to do this again in October.
Yeah.
Is there a better indicator? I mean, is there some better way, a reliable way, perhaps not as reliable, but a consistent we can use to measure price inflation?
Well, I don't know what Sean prefers, but I mean,
myself. Both of you.
Yeah. Well, I myself feel I do tend to concur that inflation is turning up, and there's something called which I cited in my column very frequently. It's called the median price index, consumer price index. The consumer price index is a skewed mean, really. And because it's skewed, as with any skewed mean, a median is a better indicator. It's simply it's actually a weighted mean. And I need a blackboard to explain that. But it's 41 different price components, and all you do is take the midpoint. So that all information is relevant. If energy and food are up, which are very volatile, and they might pull the midpoint up because they look at the array and take the middle. And that median price index has been trending up. I think it's better than what's conventionally called the core index, which is X food and energy. So that's the one I think is most reliable, and it also is indicating, as Sean has suggested, that inflation is trending up.
I think I'd concur that that's the one that we look at. I think there was a recent Fed study which suggested that their best predictor was actually CPI minus energy, but they don't actually release that one to us, which is very helpful of them. So that just goes to show the clarity in government. The median CPI is quite a nice stable one, seems to work quite well, and then you have the sort of subjective valuations of within these NAPM, ISM as it's called now, and the Philadelphia Fed survey of producers. There are prices paid and prices received and prices expected to be paid and received components, which can give you a kind of a qualitative feel for it, at least, I think.
For example, in our company, cost X compensation, for example, have been going up on a fixed basis much higher than the reported numbers, all the other figures. And anybody who spends money to feed a family or go to a bookstore knows that price inflation has been stronger than what has been reported. I'm looking really for a realistic number rather than some government number.
I see. Well, that's of course a problem. The government has sort of preempts what any private sector initiative. And it is unfortunately true that the government's fiscal agencies are more trustworthy than the few cottage industries that keep track of different numbers like retail sales and so on, because they've sort of been a little bit too much embedded with the markets. It would have taken a much, we would have required many more years of a tradition whereby private sector could keep those numbers, and unfortunately. We don't have it. I personally don't think that the government's fiscal agencies are corrupt in any obvious way. I mean, they're bureaucracies that do their job and they can make mistakes. I think it's true that in the 70s they were subject to pressure to exaggerate to recognize all the ways in which inflation was heating up, but to minimize the ways in which it was less. And when the Boston Commission came along in 96 and tried to better than Donald Trump, I'm not sure about your point. I'm not sure that you're correct in saying that. I mean, there certainly have been a lot of prices. A lot of things are cheaper. I mean, cars are cheaper, as you know. I mean, I can list a whole lot of items that are pretty cheap.
On a substitution,
it's kind of interesting. Okay. The way the media reports the CPI and the PPI, if it's up a great deal, up 0.5, they always say very quickly, but minus food and energy, it's only this. And yet if it's up just a little bit,
now they're going to do something.
Food and energy are down. Right. In the last report, it was up 0.1. And then at the end of the statement, they said, but if you include food and if you exclude food and energy, it goes from negative 0.1 to a positive rate of inflation. So the media always sort of biases it, the reporting of that statistic, to a lower level of inflation.
I would say they're often usually looking for sizzle. The media wants sizzle, and they sizzle it one way or the other. I don't know, because we can trade prices, but maybe you're right. I got to think of that more. Maybe they aren't severely understating inflation. Core inflation is we don't buy the median, we don't live by the median, but I would certainly say that median inflation. Core inflation, as measured by the mean, that's certainly coming up, so there we definitely do.
Frank?
Jim, I had a serious question about this core inflation problem.
All right, no frivolous questions.
I'm probably a bit something like a slogan. We're talking about CPI, which is still food and energy. In other words, does it represent human beings here? In other words, does it represent people who don't eat, don't drive a car?
You can call
it core inflation.
I'm sorry. Your point is well taken, Frank, and it's really the reason why, and it just indicates how tone deaf economists are, and how they sort of think in terms of statistics rather than in terms of human action and human realities. To call something the core that doesn't have food and energy in it.
Or taxes.
Yeah. And of course, it's that attempt, because food and energy are extremely volatile. I mean, energy is down, but I mean, the core person will say, but energy could be up. So it is volatile. So their idea is the statistical core, it's the trend. And as I was arguing with this gentleman, I wouldn't even use this so-called core, misnaming the core. It's really like what they would argue is the trend rate of inflation.
That's what the most looks at, the core. You're looking at core inflation.
Well, misnamed the core. It should better be called the trend rate of inflation if it's going to mean anything, to refer to the statistical issue they're trying to get at. But then even then, because inflation and because energy and food are very volatile, but even then, I think that excluding anything from what we have of prices in the CPI is foolish. we should look at the median. And also I was going to add as a footnote, you know, as some of you who follow Mr. Greenspan might know, a while ago, one of his supposedly his favorite indicator was not the CPI at all, but the personal consumption deflator as part of GNP. And that, to my mind, is just an interesting ruse that he would supposedly prefer this indicator, even though
it's always lower, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
It's always lower, that's
yeah,
why.
Yeah, he wanted it because it was lower. At that time he did. I don't know if he's mentioned too much. But it was lower. But of course, it was as obvious that he wouldn't be doing his job if he was going to look at this indicator because it comes out 2-3 weeks after the CPI, 2 weeks later. I mean, you're going to wait. You know, you're supposed to be preemptive, and you're going to use an indicator, and that comes out later.
I think
obviously, he wasn't doing it. He was just fooling us.
I think the story of the core CPI is quite an interesting one because I believe I'm correct in saying that when inflation was running out of control in the Nixon era, he called Arthur Burns in and said, "Can you fix up an indicator which doesn't look as bad?" So Burns went around taking this, that, and the other out until they had something which they could present to the public as a snow job. So that's a 30-year-old problem. So why do we expect it to be any different today?
What if I just...
Yes, Sean, you mentioned a modest bear market in bonds. I was wondering how high the 30-year might go. Also about the dollar. Is this the year that foreigners start to get up on the dollar? What kind of magnitude?
Well, the bond and stock market have been really, in essence, a zero-sum game for the last 6 months. They can't both go up together, which does tend to suggest for a start that the extraordinary extra amount of liquidity in the system is not quite doing the work that it was doing when everything was sunny 3 or 4 years ago. I would think that we could certainly see 5% in 10-year yields, maybe add another 25, 30, 40 basis points on, say 5.5% for 30-year yields in the basic scenario. Of course, the thing that we have to immediately say here to qualify our own attempts at a foolish prediction is that we all know that financial markets never do anything linearly or smoothly, and there's an enormous amount of volume which swirls around in these markets every day. There's a quick digression. Derivatives contracts and futures and all these other forms of hedging used to be an idea by which you took some economic protection or insurance from a real economic quantity changing, usually expressed through a financial claim on that economic quantity, and then you had this derivative contract which gave you some insurance. The market is so distorted with the huge volumes that the pyramid actually works the other way around, that you end up with the real economic quantity often hedging the derivative. So the point of this is that making a prediction saying the core scenario 5%, 5.5%, 10 and 30 years modest increase in interest rates is subject to the fact that we could at any point trigger a big self-fueling move within the financial market community. So the forecast is self-defeating inherently. So I would have to put that out to everybody as the health warning on it.
And the dollar?
The dollar is the one that's killed us all for the last 4 years. We've been, it's been like Mark Twain's famously exaggerated death. Every year we look at it, every year the numbers get worse, every year the US manages to find a way to keep foreigners holding on to those dollars and accumulating more. At some point there will be a revolt, whether of the market or of the geopolitical forces. There are some hints at the moment that the Russians are quietly trying to rebase their economic reserve base, although with $30 billion or so, that's not a huge amount on the world stage. The Chinese are supposed to be buying euros rather than dollars, although we've heard that before. The Europeans have introduced their new notes and coins to give some tangible evidence of fiat currency to people who had intangible evidence of a fiat currency before. But there are, of course, some economic advantages to that because people think it's money. So again, there may be some subjective valuation change, but as I say, that's the one thing that whatever else we've got right and wrong, every year we always say the dollar goes down and every year they get away with it. It's the great Houdini act.
Two questions. First, I want to get a stock market forecast from both of you. Second, whenever mainstream economists seem to be unanimous about anything or nearly unanimous, they're wrong. And certainly they are pretty unanimous about Greenspan's rate cuts and that we're going to get a recovery by the second half.
Well, actually, they're pretty unanimous that we're getting recovery right now.
Okay. So are they all of a sudden right this time?
With respect to the stock market, I'm going to have ask Sean to do both his and mine. So he's going to get most of the floor. With respect to the economy, if you look at the consensus since 1996, along with Greenspan, by the way, and I think this is the key to why Greenspan did what one of the big keys, is that they constantly underestimated the strength of the boom, the consensus did. So it wasn't wrong in the sense that the consensus wasn't wrong for a while there in terms of estimating, in terms of projecting economic growth, just underestimated the boom. At this stage, I honestly think that they're pointing the consensus. I hate to be more optimistic than the consensus, but unfortunately, I am in the sense that I think that they're pointing to all kinds of rather weak canards to believe that this is going to be a recovery, one of the sickest recoveries ever, assuming we recover. Well, let's grant that for a moment. They believe it's going to be a recovery to the tune of about 2.5%. And they use reasons that, you know, that don't really make any sense in historical context. For example, that manufacturing capacity utilization is 73%. It was 69% when capital invest 69% in 1982 when capital investment exploded by 11%. It's a number that just had them hypnotized. And so I think the consensus is wrong to that extent. But you know, with that said, as I say, it could be some sick aspect.
Does he kind of follow up on this before he talks about this prediction? When you talk about a recovery, you talk about GDP.
Yes.
Well, if I sell all my production at a loss or at cost, that adds to GDP.
I'm sorry?
You have Follies and all these sales supermarkets selling goods at no margin.
No margin.
At cost or at a loss. Yeah. That adds to GDP, yeah. But we know that the key to this whole thing is profits.
Well,
and without profits, we're going nowhere.
Yeah.
And where is the visibility for profits?
Well, actually, I mean, I don't think it's not, you know, profitless. There are profits, but I do agree with you that in this sense, probably the fourth quarter has seen the major increase in profits. Profits, there will be, you know, the rise in profits will probably not pace the rise in GDP.
There will be against the big write-offs that have been taking the $60 billion. Goodwill of write-offs they've been taking, but talking about cash profits, no one's making any money.
All right. Well, I mean, you know,
eventually the markets realize that this whole thing is just, when you have no profits, you can't base your evaluation on anything.
Well, you're talking the stock market now, but unfortunately, we don't totally agree. I think companies are declaring earnings and they're completely bogus. There are profits being made, and that. But I do at least agree with you to this extent that if I talk about a 4% rise in GDP, I don't think the profit rise will pace it.
I
agree with that. But therefore, I'm not very optimistic about the stock market, except of course it can always do surprising things. But that's the stock market.
Well, I think thank you for that. The evidence of the last several years is there have really only been two classes of purchasers of U.S. stocks, and that's been foreigners, who are now have both their own economic problems and to some extent have had the scales lifted from their eyes about the supposed effortless and vaunted superiority of the Anglo-economic model. So they're unlikely to be quite as gullible as they were. And the second category was corporates themselves, through their stock repurchase schemes, which are basically there to inflate their earnings per share to make flat revenues and poor sales and whatever look much more imposing when presented in the 2-minute soundbite on good old CNBC. Now, corporate balance sheets are so stretched that it seems unconscionable to believe that they can continue to raise debt finance simply to retire equity just for the purposes of this cosmetic addition to the reporting event. So we potentially have the two biggest sources of equity purchasing not as active as they have been in recent years. The other thing, of course, is we are talking about a vast monetary inflation. We've added more money in broad money terms to the system in the last 15 months than we did in the first 200 years of the Republic. Now, somewhere along the line, that does get spent on something, and that is possibly what's pushing all these stock valuations higher than it should be. But it may be that that requires a maintenance of pace, if not an acceleration of pace, in the absence of any justifiable economic rationale for buying these companies. And given the inordinate surge in money supply, it's very difficult now for the Fed to keep accelerating it. So on those counts, simply from the market action, I think there are huge negatives. In terms of the economic thing, I would agree with you. I think capital spending is still going to be a big problem this year. And without capitalizing expenditures, corporate profits tend to go down anyway. And we're narrowing the productive structure. We're shrinking the flow of corporate revenue, so there's less pie there to take your 6-cent slice off it. So, no, this could well be a profitless recovery. GDP will go up, but the economy will weaken. And that's an intrinsic difference that we all have to bear in mind. Although we know we'll have to realize as well, the market will react positively to the GDP numbers because it's been taught to. But it doesn't mean that things are getting better.
Sean, let me ask a question. I'm forgetting the fact point. If GDP goes up, does that mean that jobs are created? Does that mean if jobs are created, does that mean that anybody's better off? somebody is, right? I mean, profits matter. I hardly agree with you. But my projection is that GDP will rise by 4% and the unemployment rate will probably stabilize, which is, I think, a great thing.
Jobs are being created.
Yeah, 86,000 sky marshals is not going to do much. It will do wonders for GDP, but it won't do much for the future of the world, will it?
The kind of jobs being created, people with a machine on their back blowing leaves at the end of the corn people's lawns. I mean, these are not really jobs. A lot of the job creation was subpar employment, and we know that.
I'm sorry, what
period? You see 65-year-old men working at McDonald's. I mean, these are the jobs that are being...
Which period are you referring to?
The last 10 years.
The last 10 years?
Well, there's the chart you showed.
Well, the last 10 years.
The chart you showed?
The last 10 years, the average... The last several years, the inflation-adjusted wage rose substantially. The last several years, we had a 4% unemployment rate, and wage rates responded smartly. We had wage rates each year rising faster than prices, which had not been true prior to that. We had exactly what you would have expected from a very tight labor market. And so that's the reason why a lot of homes were bought. The interest rate was low. Yes, that's part of the reason why a lot of cars were bought. A lot of acquisition was made of good stuff. I mean, I guess in a way, of course, we're parsing the difference. I myself do occasionally find that there's a tendency to be a little bit too dour. I mean, when have we ever made it? I mean, sometimes I ask the bears, and look, I mean, I work in an organization with a gentleman who's been, as I confided in somebody over lunch, a gentleman who's been probably bearish from the day he was born. Nothing ever rises. Nothing ever gets better. I mean, when did we ever make material progress in this country? But we haven't made it, to some extent, over the past several years. We did. It's just that the part of the boom was unhelpful. And part of the boom, part of the rotten function is going to be unhealthy in ways that not just in the old way, but in the new way, because part of it is going to be additional protection for those buildings, and part of it is going to be duplicative computer systems. But capitalism, there still is something to capitalism in this country.
I think also we've lost over
GSEs.
I'm sorry? We've also, you should bear in mind also that the overall numbers hide the disaggregation. We've had a clear shortening of the productive structure and a collapse in aggregate earnings, in aggregate hours in the manufacturing sector. We've lost well over 1 million jobs in the last 12 months in manufacturing and transferred them into the services industry. Now, in the end, we cannot have a society which gets richer if one half of the country's attending the bars and the other are collecting the taxes off them. Somewhere or other you have to make something other than simple, immediately extinguishable services.
Well, this is going to be a point counterpoint of that town. I mean, most of what's called the service industry really works in the goods industry anyway, and the average wage in the so-called service industry is almost as high as in the manufacturing industry. I mean, services matter too, but in any case, as I say, most of what we call services is really goods-oriented, moving goods in one way or the other. And so we still live in a goods-oriented economy. But in any case, those jobs in services can pay almost as well as those jobs in manufacturing. And probably the manufacturing jobs on balance pay a bit better because they narrowed the focus with the unions. They're more unionized.
But can they pay as well? But can they create as well? We've been talking all here about the difference between spending, which is what the GDP measures, and wealth creation, which is what we need for economic progress.
Wealth creation. Well, I agree with that to some degree. Sure.
And this is following on Sean. What I'm hearing is this recovery may be unhealthy. And it's unhealthy, how long is it going to be?
Well, I think, I mean, that would be the standard Austrian response, in that this recovery will have been generated by an inordinate amount of liquidity injection, widening Dr. Garrison's gap between savings and investment, and thereby hollowing out the structure once more. So it can all look good, but it can potentially lead us to further... It's like over-revving the engine. The car needs a reservice, and all we're doing is running it faster down the road in the hope that when it gets hot, some of the stiffness in the engine will loosen up for us. But that means we're going to probably wreck the engine even more severely by the time we get to the next curve.
And this is what you guys call recovery?
The past 9 years, we're unhealthy. I mean, unhealthy things are always happening in this economy because of the unhealthiness of credit expansion. On the other hand, we also did have a productivity revival. We've also had a lot of tangible material progress on all levels. of the economy. We have that. Doesn't necessarily, just as Sean is saying, you know, the dollar is always going to collapse each year. Well, unfortunately, we can't always expect, just because it's unhealthy, that the healthy aspects won't also survive for a while. But I completely agree. It's going to be partly unhealthy because it's been fueled on credit expansion. It's also partly unhealthy for another reason, because, as I say, we're responding to September 11th.
Okay, over here.
Thank you. This balance was distributed to the way that I'm banking.
Okay.
Bad move.
I, for one, quit reading the print edition of Barron's when Robert Blauber retired, which was some years ago. And recently, I've read the online version because you get it for free if you subscribe to the Wall Street Journal. But you brought up the point about...
For free if you come here.
This question was raised by your quip about the perma bear at Barron's. And I was wondering why Abelson is no longer on the masthead. Is he retired? Or he still has his column? Is he no longer there? Is he still living? who actually writes his column?
He writes his own column. I am Al Abelson to thank that he put back that in mid-1993, when he had just gotten fired as editor-in-chief, which was early 93. He had already suggested to me a month before that I do a weekly column about the economy. And I initially balked because I didn't know that, my God, it's covering the economy, something new every week. But then when after he got fired and was a lame duck, I came to see him and asked him, would you still do the column? He said, yeah, let's stick it to those bastards. Now, of course, he was also given his column to write. He was told, by the way, for the same salary, you can also just do your column. So he took that, and that's what his situation is. But in any case, you have him and to thank if you want to thank him for the fact that I'm around writing about the economy. I thank him for that. In any case,
I wanted to ask Sean what his prediction is for the European market, and also Mr. Tide asked me to remind that he hadn't yet heard your prediction for the.
I thought I got out of that one. Too collided to be talked about. Europe's an interesting case. I mean, we are going through something of a contraction there. Europe, obviously, the danger is always that their inherently socialist governments will interfere and make matters worse rather than better. We haven't had the same malinvestment boom, and already there are signs that the GDP slowdown is being accompanied by a healthy decrease in personal consumption. So already the savings ratios are beginning to build again in Europe. So on the assumption that governments can't do enough in the short period, particularly with big political elections in France and Germany this year, which should paralyze their policy process somewhat, they may recover better, but Europe has an intrinsically lower rate of growth than the US anyway. Partly a measurement effect, because the Europeans don't cheat with all the measurements the way the US does in the GDP accounts. But you could see probably no growth in Europe for the first 6 months, but then that could be moving back towards a more healthy 2-2.5% by the end of the year, assuming government doesn't screw it up for them.
Sean's probably right in what he said, except for this idea that Europeans don't cheat on the measurements. But they cheat more than we.
In the US?
The US GDP accounts a few years ago decided to get much more honest by weighting goods and services in terms of the actual prices that are paid in any particular year. What that means is that, for example, if you produce a computer, if you have fixed weights, which is the way the Europeans do it, if you're using weights as of 1990, which is what they used, then all the computers you produce are weighted according to 1990 prices. Now, the U.S. GDP accounts knew they knew for a long time this was an absurd, always absurd. But of course, with computers, they recognized how especially absurd it would be, and so they shifted to what's called chain weighting. And according to chain weighting, this year's computers get weighted in terms of the economy, in terms of this year's prices, not 1990 prices, the way they do it in Europe and Japan. And so what actually happened when they introduced this was when the U.S. introduced it, is that it meant that the measured output was reduced in relation to the past because they, as I say, they were no longer using this distortion because they recognized the basic principle that the expanding industries always start out with high prices and then the per unit price drops when they move to mass production. The Europeans have yet to awaken to this. When they have an expanding industry, they're going to measure the output of the expanded industry in terms of the price that was charged when the industry was just coming into being and charging high prices. And so that would introduce a particular distortion with respect to computers. And so in that sense, the U.S. accounts are more honest than the German or Japanese accounts.
Do I get a refutation of that?
No.
Okay.
Do you have a number?
I'm not talking about adonic measurement. I'm talking about the one thing the critics of adonic measurement completely ignore and refuse to even try to understand, which is what's called chain rating, which is that if an adonic measurement, which by the way I would defend as a procedure, but if an adonic measurement means that a computer price is 1/10 of what a computer price was 10 years ago, then that computer is going to be weighted by 1/10 as much per unit as 10 years ago. And so hedonics has its revenge on the national income account because at the same time that hedonic measurement is being used, what also happened was they moved to what's called chain weighting, which the Europeans have yet to introduce. Now, as for hedonic measurement, all that hedonic measurement says is that if a car has power steering and power brakes, and if a few years ago the cars didn't, then if a car that costs $20,000 with power steering and power brakes versus a car that costs $20,000 without power steering and power brakes, that car is actually being sold for a lower price because of substantial quality improvements that are being introduced. That's all hedonic measurement says. And all it does is also move away from the Europeans' sort of quasi-socialist notion of how to measure output, which is that output never improves. That's absurd. That's the nation, not just to expand output, but to improve what you turn out. And hedonics only recognizes that improvements, which might have taken time and effort, necessarily mean that what you're buying is more valuable and that the output is more valuable. That, too, the Europeans, because of their socialist notions, don't understand that either. That's another problem with it. But don't worry. The national income accounts are not overstated because to the extent that hedonics lowers a computer price even more than the price has actually been lowered, that implicit price is the way in which that unit gets weighted in the national income accounts. That's how it works. Can't believe that? Well, it's true.
Okay, last one back there in the back.
Yeah, Mr. Epstein, yeah. I want to look at your statement that security is going to be a drag.
Yeah.
And first of all, let's set aside government-mandated security. Let's talk about private security measures. And then, in the sense that we wish that there weren't terrorist attacks and we didn't have to spend money on security, clearly we prefer that situation to the one we have. But in the same sense, I might wish my feet had their own soles and I didn't have to spend money on shoes. So I'm not clear why, if you count that differently than shoe spending.
Well, I mean, the only reason I count it differently is that if I have to spend my life hiding under my bed because the moment I come out from my bed, the bullets are whizzing by, then I lead a very unproductive life. I'm just a lot worse off in terms of my economic well-being. I'm having trouble crawling to the refrigerator. So that's all. It's a reality. You've got to hide under the bed. But it's just that was then and this is now. You know, things are lousy now because of this. But by the way, there might be a silver lining. It's unfortunate about the government mandated airport security workers because there too we get government doing it. But still, there might be more innovative ways to protect, to introduce security measures, and maybe it may well be that surcharge that's being imposed that might be imposed on the economy will diminish. And of course, one also hopes that there won't be any more terrorist attacks, and that will be less legitimate fear. But that's all. It's just unfortunate.
I would say to that that I take your point that if the data have changed and so our subjective valuations have ordered security higher in the level, it's not for us to say that this is a bad thing. It's an expression of human subjective choice and preference. Oh, yeah. The only thing I would say is that this is likely to be more unproductive consumption in the sense that spending money on that security isn't going to generate more capital goods and more output in the future. So a switch of consumption one to the other, that's our choice. Fine, we have that instead. But it's taking away from the pool that we can be investing in more productive means, presumably.
Exactly right. That's all. It's just too bad. But we have to live with it, absolutely.
Okay, we're out of time. We'll have some time for informal questions, but...